I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Two recent high-profile grand jury rulings have raised some questions about how the system works. In Ferguson, Missouri, a grand jury decided against bringing criminal charges against police officer Darren Wilson for the shooting death of Michael Brown. A Staten Island grand jury voted against bringing criminal charges against police officer Daniel Pantaleo for the death of Eric Garner. Transcripts of the Ferguson trial were made public while the arrest of Garner was caught on tape, viewed by the public. Today we start off with a brief history of grand juries from David Harris. He's a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, where he teaches criminal procedure and researches police conduct. David Harris, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be with you, Marty. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Let's go back to English law. Let's go back a number of centuries. Where do grand juries come from when we look at English law?
Well, they go way back into the Middle Ages, Marty, and this was a development that was an improvement over the way the law used to work in England way, way back centuries ago. It was always the case that the king and the people around the king could use the criminal system as a way to attack and even kill their enemies, accuse them of treason or that sort of thing. And they were also, of course, at full liberty to use the criminal system against regular people with even greater ease. And the grand jury was set up as an institution to stand between the power of the king, the sovereign, and everyone else, so that some number of regular folks, the grand jurors, had the power to withhold charges from that the king or the king's administration would like brought against any particular individual. So it was never a body that heard criminal charges. That was up to the regular old petty jury. But it was a charging body, and it would stand as a shield to protect people against overreach by the crown, by the government, by the sovereign. And that's really the reason that the grand jury found acceptance in the colonies and was, in fact, put into the United States Bill of Rights when the country was created.
In fact, I'm looking at the Fifth Amendment here, and there it is, a reference to grand juries.
Absolutely. It was considered an important protection by the founders for people to be able to act in concert with their political views, to stand up to authority, or simply to protect against government overreach. And that's kind of where it stood until about the 20th century. It was a shield against government power, and then things changed. The change really was that the other role of the grand jury, which had really been kind of a small thing, was that the grand jury could be a sword. It could be an investigating sword. It could be a weapon for prosecutors to root out corruption, to address political corruption or things like that. And it had some very significant powers in both the sword and the shield iterations. It had the power to act in secrecy, as we all know. It had the power to order people to appear and give testimony. It had the power through the judge and the prosecutor running the grand jury to confer immunity. So even if you didn't want to talk, they could give you immunity from the consequences that would waive your Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination. They could get information on you, from you on pain of contempt. So in the 20th century, we really see the grand jury blossom as an investigating tool, a very powerful investigating tool for prosecutors. And that was a big, big change. It seldom now provides the shielding function. It usually acts simply as an investigating sword.
Well, we all know that ham sandwich comment about prosecutors.
Absolutely.
And grand juries. Is there some truth to that, that the prosecutor can essentially indict a ham sandwich?
Yeah, that's the old saying, and I think there's a lot of truth to it. You see, the grand jury is nominally run by the administrative or chief judge in the area, in the jurisdiction. But really, the judge has only a very small administrative role and will resolve disputes. Grand juries are run by prosecutors for the purpose of prosecution. The prosecutor is the only lawyer in the room. The prosecutor decides what evidence goes in front of the grand jury and has no obligation to put defense evidence in, to let a defendant testify or call a defense witness. The prosecution decides usually beforehand what they want out of the grand jury and brings evidence that props up that theory. That's not to say it's something nefarious. I'm just saying this is the way it is used in the modern era and has been for years. The grand jury hears the information that the prosecutor wants and almost always does what the prosecutor asks. The prosecutor coaches the grand jury through the investigation, suggests the proper charges, drafts the documents, and has the grand jury vote on them and asks them to vote for indictments. That's the way it works. That's the old saying. And, you know, so when we do grand jury study in my criminal procedure class, I put up a slide of a legal magazine cover from 15 years ago, and it's just a picture of a ham sandwich. And everybody knows that that's about grand jury reform or something about grand juries. So this is the reality of how grand juries work. They do what prosecutors tell them to do in the overwhelming number of cases.
And I want to break down some of the other parts of grand jury. Now, their responsibility is, or their goal, I guess, is to determine whether there is probable cause, whether a crime has been committed, and that then this case can go forward. What is the meaning of probable cause?
Well, and this is a very important point. It is not an institution that determines guilt or innocence. It only determines whether or not there is enough evidence to go forward with a trial. And the standard for that judgment is probable cause, a probability that a crime has been committed and that the person under investigation or the target is the one who committed it. It is less evidence than the civil standard of more probable than not. It is more evidence than the stop and frisk standard of reasonable suspicion. The Supreme Court has never defined for us in a sort of percentage or how much evidence weigh probable cause, what that means. But the Supreme Court has said over and over it's a probability-based common sense judgment as to whether or not the case should go forward. And so while we don't have a solid black and white definition, it really isn't a lot of evidence. And it is only for the purpose of saying whether or not a case can go forward to trial. That's the only judgment the grand jury makes when it votes an indictment.
And how does one get to sit on a grand jury?
Well, a grand jury membership is determined differently in different jurisdictions by different officers. Usually, in most systems, the administrative or chief judge of the circuit, that person picks the grand jurors randomly off the same list from which petty jurors are drawn. In most jurisdictions, that means a list consisting of all people who have driver's licenses, who are registered to vote, common things like that. And so it will be a body that has a particular number of people, which may not be the customary 12. From what we know of petty juries, it can be, as in the federal system, as many as 23. In Missouri, it's a 12-person grand jury, and they need have only 9 people agree. So it takes a lot of different shapes and numbers, but the common thing is that this is a group of people randomly selected just to hear evidence of whether there should be charges.
What is the thinking behind the secrecy behind grand juries?
Well, it does perform a very important function. If, for instance, you are investigating a criminal organization, an ongoing organization or set of offenses, there's real good reason not to tip anybody off if you can avoid it. So you want to do that investigation in secrecy so that they don't know that the investigation is happening, your targets, that is, and they don't suddenly, you know, shut down and move to a different state or even a different country. There are sometimes investigations of political figures or of public companies. And if word were to get out about the investigation, the damage would be significant to the reputation of a public figure or to the, even the stock price of a publicly traded company. And it may be that the grand jury decides in the end there isn't probable cause to decide to go forward. And so the damage to a public figure or a public company would be quite great. The other reason that secrecy is important goes the other way, and that is that it allows the grand jury and the prosecutor that runs it to sort of have the power of this kind of secret proceeding where there's nobody really present except the grand jurors and the prosecutor. And that that brings a lot of force along with it. If nobody can know, except maybe your own lawyer, who incidentally doesn't get to come in the room with you, that you're there and nobody has any power to disclose it, that itself is a powerful force in getting people to talk and give up the evidence that they might have.
We actually have a defense attorney waiting in the wings in just a couple of minutes. So where are the defense attorneys under a grand jury proceeding?
Well, states and other jurisdictions, they vary on this. But the most common rule is that grand jurors never hear from the defense, that the prosecutor does not have to allow lawyers into the grand jury room. Now, there are a growing number of states that allow that at the discretion of the prosecutor, but they are still in the minority as far as I know. So what happens is, this is true in the federal system, is that the lawyer is allowed to wait outside of the grand jury room, and the person being asked the questions, the subject of the day's investigation, is allowed to leave and consult with his or her lawyer outside the room before giving an answer, which if you think about it, it's about the most awkward and bizarre thing that there is. The lawyer, though, is not allowed to be in the grand jury room in most jurisdictions unless the prosecutor gives consent, invites that person in. So it's a very odd sort of institution in a setting in which most of our legal institutions, most of the time, operate in the open. We have open trials. It takes a great deal of evidence to close a trial. That sort of thing is the norm. And here we have this institution from the Middle Ages that operates with a great deal of secrecy, with very considerable power given to only one side in our adversary system, and justified because, well, all it does is charge. You can always fight off the charges later. That really doesn't recognize the fact that once the charges are there, it often creates huge pressure on people to plead guilty or to take other kinds of actions that they might not if the whole thing was operating in the same way that our criminal justice system generally does, which is in an adversarial way in the open.
On that note, David Harris, thanks so much for getting our conversation started.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. He's a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, teaches criminal procedure and researches police conduct. And again, getting us started as we talk about, debate, discuss the role of grand juries. And again, two guests waiting in the wings. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The process of implementing grand juries has come under some scrutiny due to recent decisions in Ferguson, Missouri and Staten Island, New York. We just talked with David Harris, a short history of grand juries. Now we want to talk about how they are implemented in Pennsylvania and talk about whether there's a process for rethinking or perhaps even reforming grand juries. And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Michael Engel is a partner in the Philadelphia-based law firm of Greenblatt, Pierce, Engel, Funt, and Flores. He's also former president of the Pennsylvania Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Michael Engel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Glad to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us, Edward McMahon. He's a first assistant district attorney of Philadelphia, a job he's had since 2011. He's a veteran homicide prosecutor for 25 years. Ed McMahon, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good morning, Marty. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And again, to our our listeners. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Michael, do you think it is a good time because of these two high-profile cases? None of them happened in Pennsylvania. But there's so much now public focus on what grand juries are and what they aren't. Is this a good time to sort of revisit grand juries in the year 2014?
It certainly seems to be. The Michael Brown and the Eric Garner grand jury investigations have sparked a significant amount of debate on this issue. And there has been debate in Pennsylvania between prosecutors and defense attorneys and judges over the years about how we work our process with grand juries. And now that these stories are at the national forefront, it certainly seems like a good time to talk about it.
Well, Ed, you're a prosecutor. One of the quotes that I ran across that a grand jury is putty in the hands of the prosecutors. And as we heard from David Harris, I mean, in many ways, prosecutors do call the shots in a grand jury.
I think it's clearly true that a prosecutor has a tremendous amount of power in a grand jury setting. But I would say, at least in Pennsylvania, at least in my own experience, that there's far more checks and balances maybe than in a lot of other places. First of all, in Pennsylvania, the defense attorney of a witness is allowed to be present in the grand jury room.
So they don't have to come and don't have to leave and come back?
No, they're allowed to be in by operation of state law. They're allowed to be in the room with their client. So that's one difference. I mean, I think at least in Philadelphia, my own experience, the president judge will appoint a judge to administer the grand jury, and that judge doesn't take just a hands-off role. There's a more active role. They read all the transcripts. They actually have to approve any grand jury charge that we're going to give to the grand jury and, in fact, approve any charging documents, presentments, reports, things of that nature. So I think in Pennsylvania, the subset of cases that go before a grand jury are a lot smaller than in a lot of other states as well. So I think practice is a lot different in Pennsylvania maybe than in New York or other places.
Michael, let me go back to you. You are a defense attorney, you know, certainly have worked as a defense attorney. And there is this question about the role of a defense attorney when it comes to a grand jury, a little different in Pennsylvania. But nonetheless, what are some of the restrictions, I guess, on a defense attorney?
Well, the practice and the role of being a criminal defense attorney in the grand jury in the federal system is very different than in Pennsylvania, at least with respect to investigating grand juries. Because in PA, we have investigating grand juries. And in 2012, in limited witness intimidation cases, there are now indicting grand juries. But as Professor Harris said, in the federal grand jury context and in the federal system, the defense lawyer is outside the room. You are very much outside of what's going on in that room. Your client must then report that information to you. Whereas in Pennsylvania, the Investigating Grand Jury Act allows for defense counsel to be in the room where I'm in a position to hopefully more directly advise my client about whether or not there are any perils for them in answering certain questions.
I mean, can you say, I object?
No. The Grand Jury Act does not allow a defense attorney to do what we like to do in a courtroom when we're in front of a judge, but we can't raise an objection. But we do have the ability, and I have debated this with certain prosecutors, not my friend Mr. McCann here, but with certain other prosecutors in Pennsylvania, about whether a defense attorney can actively tap the client on the shoulder and say, we need to talk before you answer that question, or whether or not it's the client's obligation to turn around and look at their lawyer for advice. I've always been the believer that the person's Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination and the role of defense counsel in Pennsylvania grand jury practice is such that it should allow for a slightly more active role in protecting the client's interests.
You mentioned the Fifth Amendment. It's so interesting because the grand jury process or system is part of the Fifth Amendment.
Yes. It creates a scenario in which the government is able to investigate and potentially bring charges against one of our citizens. But the most important part of the Fifth Amendment is that protection that we each have, that right to remain silent, and the inability for the government to compel us to give evidence against ourselves or to incriminate ourselves. And that Fifth Amendment right must be protected in the grand jury process.
Let me go back to you, Ed, and this is, again, I'm just quoting from, because I'm no lawyer, from the research that I was doing. The grand juries have been described as secret trials without cross-examination where the prosecutors control the witnesses. Fair, unfair?
I don't know if it's fair to call them secret trials. But again, I mean, I think anybody would be naive to deny the prosecutor's power in front of a grand jury. But, you know, you take an oath as a prosecutor to uphold the law and to protect everyone's rights, even someone who may have a Fifth Amendment right. Maybe that doesn't happen everywhere. I hope that happens in our office. But the point is that as a prosecutor in general terms, whether you have a grand jury or not, you have tremendous power. I mean, you have the power to bring charges that are going to take away somebody's liberty. So anytime you exercise prosecutorial power, you're supposed to do it in a way that's consistent with your oath to uphold justice. And a grand jury is just another scenario, another place where that's important to do.
And we heard our first guest talk about the sort of pros and cons of having a trial in secret or in private.
Sure. I mean, Marty, I think there's an interesting statistic that talks about how powerful a tool a grand jury can be. The Bureau of Justice Statistics indicated that in 2010, United States attorneys across the country sought approximately 162,000 indictments in that year. And of those 162,000 times they were in front of a grand jury seeking charges, grand jurors declined to indict only in 11 cases.
11 out of 162,000.
11 in 162,000, which tells you how powerful the process can be for the prosecutor. I think what we've seen in the debate in the Ferguson case, for example, with the Michael Brown grand jury certainly indicates that a prosecutor can use a grand jury as a tool to bring charges, and sometimes the prosecutor can use a grand jury as a tool to avoid bringing charges against an individual, depending upon the circumstances. It is a very difficult process from the defense perspective because of grand jury secrecy. We don't like what we consider to be star chamber proceedings in this country. That's why we prefer transparency to secrecy in most contexts. I think that secrecy can be very dangerous under certain circumstances because we don't know what's going on and we don't know whether or not the rights of individuals are being protected. I'm certainly not disparaging Mr. McCann or any of the prosecutors that I've dealt with in the past. Certainly they have a basis for wanting to bring certain charges. But from a defense perspective, we're concerned about how is that process actually taking place. And when you're not getting to see a large portion of it and you're not privy to much of that information, it does raise concerns.
I would just say a couple things
about that. I mean, I think, again, I would say a lot of people, I think, because of these cases, and understandably so, have elevated the procedure of a grand jury and started questioning that. But I think it goes beyond that, frankly. I think the point is the folks in those communities and in many communities, unfortunately, throughout the United States don't believe that law enforcement is legitimate in some respects and don't have a trust of law enforcement. And that's one of the things that we've clearly spent a lot of time trying to do, particularly since Seth Williams got elected district attorney in Philadelphia, and that is to make the system as a whole, not just the grand jury, but everything, seem more legitimate to the citizens. That's really the key, because you can misuse any process in the criminal justice system. But the point is, if you are legitimate, if you are perceived to be legitimate by the citizens because you act with fairness at every point along the way, then a single decision or a procedure that you use, like a grand jury, is going to be perceived in that fashion by people.
I mean, one of the criticisms of these two grand jury decisions is that prosecutors and police are essentially on the same team. Can you respond to that?
Well, I mean,
this is Ed McMahon.
Yeah. McCann.
McCann,
I think,
sorry.
That's okay. I think that that can be a perception in a community that's what people's experience is. And I know that some people in Philadelphia believe that. And I think that that's the key for us in law enforcement. It's something that, again, D.A. Williams has worked really hard to do this since he took office in 2010. And it's something that we talk about all the time in our office, and that is for the public to perceive that we're being fair to everyone, not just to the 18-year-old – who got caught selling drugs in North Philadelphia, but to everyone. That means the police, that means the clergy, that means anybody that we deal with, that we have to be perceived to be fair. And I think that that's something that we're trying to do, but that's the reaction, I think, to the grand jury decisions is less about the procedure of the grand jury and more about people's feelings about the legitimacy of the criminal justice system in the places where they live.
Oh, and picking up on that, Michael, I mean, as I said, the arrest of the person in Staten Island, people got to watch that. They could watch that and they could come to some kind of determination what happened on the street there. Interestingly, the transcripts of the Ferguson trial have been made public, so we can read that information and decide whether it was a fair process or not. So this stuff is now out in the open.
Well, in the Ferguson case, it is. We haven't seen as much because the procedure is different in New York, from what I understand, where the prosecutor must seek permission in order to put the grand jury material out there for public consumption. And generally, that does not happen. In the Ferguson case, it's a different procedure in Missouri. And I think that for the public to be able to evaluate what went on in that grand jury process certainly is an important part, again, getting back to transparency versus secrecy. But hitting on a point that Mr. McCann made about the difficulties in dealing with the process, and I do understand that certain people have a mistrust of law enforcement. I do think that the law enforcement officers don't get enough credit for the hard work that they do. And they have a very difficult job. I think one of the major criticisms here, though, is that you don't often see a grand jury investigation or probe that is as detailed as what we saw, particularly in Ferguson, when the putative defendant is not a police officer. You don't often see exculpatory evidence presented to a grand jury, the detail of forensic analysis presented to a grand jury when a civilian is accused of killing another individual. And the question then that comes up is, why is the process different when the person that might be charged is a police officer? Is there a double standard? And I think that that's...
Is there, do you think?
In my experience, there is. In my experience, grand juries are often impaneled and used to investigate cases where police officers are potential defendants. Sometimes prosecutors... What I will say is they punt on the decision about whether or not they should bring charges and put a matter in front of a grand jury so that they can say, well, you know, the grand jury decided this. But again, it also takes us back to the question of where is the prosecutor steering the investigation and the evidence in front of the grand jury, and how is that process being structured such that it may lead to no charges against a police officer under those circumstances?
Do you want to respond to that, and then we'll get to some of our calls?
I mean, I certainly think you can do that as a prosecutor. You could do that. But, I mean, I think the point, again, returns to my own experience and practice in Philadelphia and what the emphasis of the folks that are the leaders in the criminal justice system, Commissioner Ramsey, District Attorney Williams. I don't think there's any question that under this police commissioner and under this DA that there's been a serious effort to root out police corruption. There's been a lot of prosecutions. There's been a lot of arrests. And I think, again, it gets back to not the individual proceeding of the grand jury, because the grand jury can be used or abused in any number of ways by somebody. But the point is, to make the whole process look legitimate, you have to treat everybody the same. So can that happen? Yes, but that's not the effort that we're undertaking in Philadelphia.
Let me get that. It looks like Marlene from Medford to join us. Marlene, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, and good morning.
Morning.
I have to agree with something your guest just said. I felt abused as the chairperson of a grand jury a few years ago. Abused or manipulated, I don't know what. It seemed terribly unfair. He was presenting the prosecutor's case without any rebuttal, and I think I and the rest of the grand jurors, felt manipulated, and there was little that we could do about it.
Well, and we can't get deep into your case. Marlene, can you say how your grand jury decided on a particular—
It went along with everything the prosecutor indicted every time he said to. I guess I should have stood up and been more forceful or something, but I just felt I was— in a hopeless situation.
Well, Marlene, I'm glad you called in. Let me toss this to you, Michael. I've heard this before, not necessarily from callers, but sort of feeling that the jurors maybe don't entirely understand what the process is, and maybe not even realizing they're just getting one side.
Well, it's incumbent upon the prosecutor to provide instructions along with the supervising grand jury judge to give instructions on the law to those people who sit and give of service as grand jurors. That can happen in a very effective way, depending upon the judge or the prosecutor, or it could happen in a less effective way. And unfortunately, that can place grand jurors in a difficult posture. Clearly, as Marlene has indicated, she may have had reservations about some of the charges, but she's one of a number of votes. And depending upon the jurisdiction that you're in, the majority vote that is required in order to bring charges, it depends on whether you're in the federal system or in Pennsylvania or New Jersey. But obviously, jurors are called upon to review the evidence as best they can. That's difficult, as Marlene said, when you're getting only one side of the story.
And as our first guest said, Ed, which is that grand juries don't determine guilt or innocence. It's whether a case can go forward, whether there's enough, I guess, information or evidence to go forward.
Right, correct. I mean, but again, I think it speaks of the difference in the procedure in Marlene State, New Jersey, and in Pennsylvania. I mean, the cases that go before a grand jury in our state are a very small percentage of the overall cases. Most defendants in Pennsylvania, even defendants that have been recommended for charges by an investigating grand jury, are entitled to a preliminary hearing. It's only the cases, as Michael said earlier, where it can be certified that witness intimidation has or is likely to occur, usually in violent crime cases or witness intimidation cases where an indicting grand jury is used in Pennsylvania. And again, that's a very, very small percentage of the overall caseload in Pennsylvania.
Marlene, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. We are talking about grand juries. And the voice you just heard, Edward McCann, first assistant district attorney of Philadelphia, a veteran homicide prosecutor of some 25 years. Also with us, Michael Engel. He's a partner in the Philadelphia-based law firm of Greenblatt, Pierce, Engel, Funt & Flores. He's also former president of the Pennsylvania Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Looking at my computer here, we can't necessarily relitigate what happened in Ferguson or Staten Island. Much more to talk about. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Grand juries have their roots in English law. They're included in the Fifth Amendment. They have also come under some scrutiny as a result of some decisions, one in Ferguson, Missouri, the other in Staten Island, New York. And again, talking with two Philadelphia or Pennsylvania-based lawyers, Michael Engel and Edward McCann. And again, calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Michael, if I can go back to you, I was reading about some calls for reforms. One was a right to counsel for witnesses when it comes to grand jury, a little more sunlight or a little more sunshine into the grand jury proceedings. Does that make sense to you? Or are there other reforms you think that should be at least under consideration?
Well, certainly in those jurisdictions that perhaps don't have the type of procedures that we have in place in Pennsylvania for dealing with witness issues and the right to counsel, that type of reform certainly would be appropriate. Under the Pennsylvania Grand Jury Act, witnesses have the right to counsel. It's a statutory right. It's not a constitutional right, believe it or not. But each witness is instructed by the supervising grand jury with respect to those rights and informed in Pennsylvania that if they can't afford a lawyer, one will be appointed for them, much like if they were charged in a criminal case itself. So I don't think that's where we have issues in Pennsylvania. I think that there are areas relating to issue of grand jury secrecy where reform certainly is appropriate. One area of debate that is very big of late is whether or not the attorney for the witness and the witness can be sworn to secrecy. Because generally, under the Pennsylvania Grand Jury Act, a number of people are sworn to secrecy, the prosecutor, the stenographer, people in law enforcement who are involved in the prosecution team. But the Grand Jury Act says, as a general matter, witnesses and their lawyers are not subject to grand jury secrecy. Much like in the federal system, Rule 6 says you could go out and take an ad in the newspaper and say I was in front of a grand jury. But of late, prosecutors are asking supervising grand jury judges in Pennsylvania to swear lawyers and witnesses to secrecy. That's supposed to require a hearing. Doesn't usually happen. And that's an area where I think reform is greatly needed.
Do you agree with that? Disagree with that, Ed?
I don't exactly know what Mike's talking about in terms of specific cases, but I mean, I think I would go back to what Professor Harris said, that the secrecy provisions are really important in ongoing investigations for a number of reasons, one of which is to protect people that may not end up getting indicted from that testimony sort of being leaked to the public. And sometimes it's necessary in an ongoing investigation to make sure people don't talk about what happens in the grand jury.
But just picking up on something Michael said, 162,000 cases, 11 not indictments?
11 instances in 2010 where the grand jury didn't return what's called a true bill.
A true bill.
Sure, but a lot of times what happens is in a grand jury situation, you may have testimony that comes out about somebody that may not rise to the level of a criminal act, but it may be something that they don't necessarily want to have streamed out throughout the public. I mean, it might be sensitive information. There's different things that can happen in a grand jury that might cause someone to want their testimony to not get out to the public.
Let me see what Elliot from South Philadelphia say. Elliot, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Marty, thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Starting with, and I'll try to keep my comments as brief as possible.
That'd be
starting
great.
With what the Crempro professor had initially outlined when the show started. In Crempro 1, when I discovered the 5th and 14th Amendments, they kind of made my eyebrows raise. By the time I got to Crempro 2 and I discovered bail to jail, then I was fundamentally in distrust of the criminal process. By the time I got to advanced common law, I was fundamentally in distrust of the government.
Mm.
I'm from the Grace Ferry section of South Philadelphia and managed to make it through a law school. What I would say, because there are lots of comments that I could make, but I'll try to be as brief as I can.
Just do one, Elliot, if you don't mind. Go ahead.
In the city and county of Philadelphia, and in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, the lion's majority of cases, you walk down 12th and Philbert into the CJC, will never require an indictment. An indictment never occurs. There's a preliminary hearing which leads to a preliminary arraignment which leads to a preliminary hearing where the judge, in and of him or herself, decides whether there is sufficient evidence to move a case to trial.
Okay.
So whenever you hear about a grand jury being convened in the Commonwealth, citizens need to get skeptical quickly. Number two, and counsel can rebut me if this is the case, but there is no other branch of government where I know of where people have the power, where government officials have the power of the prosecutor. In brief, we live in a system of selective prosecutions where only prosecutors determine which cases move forward and which don't, which means that for citizens, you need to scrutinize and agitate your prosecutor. And the same way you scrutinize and agitate your mayor, your governor, even your president, or any other branch of government.
Well, Elliot, I know I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and let me toss that first over to you, Ed.
I don't really disagree with anything Elliot said in terms of scrutinizing and agitating your prosecutor. I think that's absolutely appropriate. I think it's necessary for us to do our jobs well. We have to be under a microscope. And I think his other point is well taken as well. We have a lot of power. So to the extent that we have that power that gets exercised on a daily basis in everyday citizens, it's better for the system as a whole if there's scrutiny and people are paying attention to what we're doing and making sure that we're doing things fairly.
But, Mike, why not just have a preliminary hearing? I mean, why use a grand jury?
Well, this is something that's become a debate since the grand juries in an indicting context have come back in Pennsylvania in 2012. Certainly from the defense bar's perspective, we say have a preliminary hearing. Have an elected judicial official make a determination of probable cause after hearing some of the defense perspective at a hearing. Having witnesses subjected to cross-examination, which brings out perhaps the other side of things. It appears that in these witness intimidation cases where we bypass preliminary hearings now in Pennsylvania, it is a limited number. Ed is definitely right that it's a limited number, but there is still a staggering number of cases that go through the Philadelphia criminal justice system by way of indictment there. And especially when this is it witness intimidation is likely to occur. And what people, I think, don't necessarily appreciate about that process is that the document that goes to the supervising grand jury judge that establishes this probable cause for that witness intimidation is something the defense never, ever sees, ever. We never, ever have the opportunity to review it or challenge it. And that kind of creates that star chamber process that we don't like in this country. And I think the secrecy there is a problem. I understand that witness intimidation can be an issue, but what's interesting is even when this was brought out originally, that this was going to be used in homicide cases where witness intimidation has been declared as so prevalent in the city, homicide prosecutors in Philadelphia have all but abandoned using the indicting grand jury process because it doesn't serve to preserve witness testimony, and it hasn't worked as well as I think some of the architects of that plan thought it would. I definitely think that we're under a circumstance where if we put a case in front of a judge, a lot of times those cases don't make it past a preliminary hearing. A grand jury allows for a case that otherwise would be dismissed early to go farther into the system and perhaps keep a defendant locked up longer.
Elliot, thanks for the call. Ed, looks like you want to say
something.
Yeah,
I disagree with a lot of what Mike just said. I mean, I don't think that it serves to dismiss the cases earlier because they're being dismissed on their merits. I think it served for many years to have cases dismissed because witnesses didn't come to court because they were afraid to come to court. As the Inquirer series documented back in 2009, over half of violent felonies were getting dismissed before they even got to trial. And witness intimidation is rampant. And Michael's right in terms of homicide, but that's a strategic decision that the office made in terms of preserving testimony. You have to do that in front of a judge and having witnesses cross-examined. But in domestic violence cases and non-fatal shooting cases and witness intimidation cases, and Marty, we did a study a couple years ago. There's witness intimidation occurs in or around the CJC where someone gets arrested. That's basically once a week.
CJC.
The Criminal Justice Center. So, I mean, it is a rampant. It's a huge problem. And, you know, I don't think it's a star chamber proceeding when you have several well-respected judges that sort of review everything that goes on and make sure that the discovery is passed in a timely fashion and that we're acting appropriately. And we also have two supervisors in the grand jury, the indicting grand jury at all time, to act as a check against, you know, the younger ADAs that are doing these cases.
Looks like you want to say something, Michael.
Well, I would just say that this isn't about the integrity of the supervising grand jury judges. It's about the fact that the defendant has already been arrested in these cases. And the question is, how are we going to get to a determination through a screening process of, is this case going to make it to a trial level and how far is this case going to go? And what we've seen, PACDL has been studying this along with the Defender Association. PACDL, the Pennsylvania Association of Criminal Defense
Okay,
Lawyers.
Okay.
And the Defender Association of Philadelphia. And what we've seen from our review of the case numbers and the statistics is that, by and large, these cases make it to the Court of Common Pleas, but then they're either dismissed, they're either pled down to misdemeanors for probation, or they're resulting in acquittals at trial. And that just seems to do nothing but give people high bails because of witness intimidation allegations, keep them in custody in cases where they otherwise wouldn't be, and it doesn't result in the case getting anywhere that it wouldn't have ended up earlier in the process if there had been a preliminary hearing.
Let me put something else here. We've been focusing on grand jury decisions not in Pennsylvania, but Ed, you reminded me that you were involved in the grand jury proceedings involving the case of a little girl, Danielle Kelly, who was being it's just sort of horrific abuse and neglect that happened there. Also the Gosnell case. This is the abortion doctor that was essentially murdering babies in his office there. That's the other side, I guess, of how grand juries can perhaps even change law.
I mean, I definitely think the Danielle Kelly case was transformative in terms of child protective services in Philadelphia.
It was just a horrifying case.
It was a horrifying case, but it also, through the grand jury report and the arrests that we made on that case, I think it clearly helped to drive change in the system. Now, obviously, there's other drivers of change in the system. That we, Amory Ambrose was an exceptional commissioner of the Department of Human Service, and she was committed to change. But the things that we said in that report and the recommendations that we made and the light that we shed on what was going on in that organization, I think, were also key in changing the dynamic of that organization. Mm-hmm. Gosnell case the same way. The clergy abuse investigation of the Catholic Church the same way. I mean, they can be – grand juries can be very, very effective in those sort of long-term system-wide type of investigations that we in the Philadelphia DA's office have used them for on several occasions.
Would you agree with that, Michael? Those kinds of cases?
Well, yes, I think that there's certainly value that comes out of what we learn from those investigations. But I think what we need to make clear is that with an investigating grand jury in Pennsylvania, where charges are recommended, the grand jury returns what's called a presentment, which is a recommendation to the prosecutor to bring charges. What Ed's been talking about are cases where after a full investigation, the grand jury issues a report. Now, the report does not recommend charges necessarily against an entity or a group of individuals. The report sometimes is just a scathing review of a process where there perhaps was failure. And that can be dangerous. Mm. That type of report can be very damaging in a white-collar context to a large corporation or a company, to public officials in a corruption-type process or an investigation relating to government. Those presentments or those reports, rather, they're written by the prosecutor and they're put out there in the public domain. They can be very damaging to an individual or an entity not charged with any crime. And interestingly, in Pennsylvania, there is a mechanism in the Grand Jury Act that says that the supervising judge can give the party being criticized the right to submit a rebuttal. Oh. But I will say in 15 years of practice, I've never once seen a grand jury judge let the criticized party submit a rebuttal. So grand jury reports can be very informative, but they can also be a very dangerous weapon.
We had a comment from McLaughlin. I was on a Pennsylvania grand jury for 30 weeks. Could they discuss some of the differences between federal and state grand juries? Can you take that on, Ed?
In terms of the time limits, actually, in Pennsylvania, the grand jurors can stay, I think, up to 18 months and then can be extended longer than
that.
How
do you work and be on a grand jury? I mean, have a job. Yeah.
Typically speaking, you get a lot of government-type employees, sometimes retired people. But usually what they do in Philadelphia is they sit 2 days a week. Oftentimes, it's not for the full day. Mm-hmm. But it is a very difficult undertaking. And I think as citizens do in regular jury service, my experience has been that citizens get very invested in the process and take it very, very seriously.
And the difference between federal and state grand juries, Michael?
Well, with federal grand juries, they do sit presumptively for a period of 18 months. In certain federal districts that are of a certain population size and where they can indicate that there is a high crime level or a certain type of investigation that they want to conduct, it can be extended to 36 months. The federal grand juries, similar process where they are giving of their time, they are doing it several days a week, where they're coming in and listening to multiple cases being presented by multiple prosecutors. It's a lot to keep straight. It's a lot to keep organized. But these are citizens who are really giving of themselves and their time. And it's a critical part of the process, obviously.
And we're almost out of time here. Do they get paid for their service?
It's my understanding they get a very, very small per diem.
Yes.
Correct.
How small are we talking at?
It's very small. Michael's right. I don't know exactly
like
how small, but maybe
something?
Something like that.
Yeah,
yes.
It might pay for their parking in Center City, Philadelphia.
Right. Exactly.
Well, we could go on. My thanks to both of you for coming in and helping us understand grand juries, seeing it from two different perspectives. Thanks so much.
Thank you,
Marty.
You're welcome. Michael Engel, partner in the Philadelphia-based law firm Greenblatt, Pierce Engel, Funt, and Flores, also former president of the Pennsylvania Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Also with us, Ed McCann, first assistant district attorney in Philadelphia and a veteran homicide prosecutor. And we began our conversation with David Harris from the University of Pittsburgh Law School. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and how to find us on Twitter and how to find us on Facebook as well. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thanks for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.